listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Grassroots, listener-supported, solar-powered radio broadcasting live from the Cultural District here in Fairfield, Iowa. This is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me today is not Caroline.
I'm not Caroline.
Not my mother.
I'm not her mother.
No, with me today is a gentleman who has co-hosted with us previously on the show when we have topics that I find of special interest to him, because this gentleman definitely belongs on the radio.
A gentleman? Why, thank you very much.
So our co-host today is Paul Gandy. He is an attorney here in Fairfield, Iowa. He's also on the board of the Keeping History Alive Foundation. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Paul.
Thank you, Monica. I'm very happy to be here.
And before you introduce our guest today, why don't you tell us a little bit about the Keeping History Alive Foundation?
Be glad to. The Keeping History Alive Foundation was founded by Patty Miller. She's the president and our visionary. The Keeping History Alive Foundation, or KHAF, primary mission is to preserve the history of the civil rights movement, particularly the civil rights movement as it involved Iowa residents. Patty Miller, in 1963, I believe, the summer of 1963, spent several weeks in Mississippi, the heart of the Delta, as a freedom volunteer, teaching young people, young African-American boys and girls, for several weeks. Often the very first interaction they would have, or the only interaction they'd ever had with someone who wasn't African-American and was in a position of a dominance. And she would teach them, who were Caucasian, she would interact with them and teach them, as did several other volunteers from Iowa and around the country during that Freedom Summer. So it's been something that's transformed her life from that moment on, and she's made it her life's mission, one of her life's missions, one of her life's goals, to preserve that history. And so we work hard to keep history alive and remember that particular period.
And our guest today is keeping history alive as well, isn't she?
That's right.
Yeah. So who do we have today on Writers' Voices?
Today we have Rochelle Chase. Rochelle Chase is a senior business analyst for Fortune 500 companies and a published romance author with an interest in African-American history. She currently lives in Iowa. She tells the unique story of Buxton, Iowa, by combining quotes extracted from oral histories of Buxton residents with rare photographs from the State Historical Society of Iowa, the Monroe County Historical Society and Museum, and the private collections of folks like John Jacobs and Michael W. Limburger.
So, Rochelle, welcome to Writers' Voices.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about how you came to write this book, which is titled Lost Buxton, Images of America.
Well, like so many things, I think, in my life, it wasn't exactly planned. I was, as you mentioned, writing romance and writing for Kensington Publishing in New York. And my romance writing instructor at that time, a woman by the name of Lee Michaels, lived in Ottumwa. And I used to visit her. And she had said, oh, we've got this town. You've got to see this town. And so I said, okay, next time I'm there, I'd love to see it. So then she and her husband took me out to the Buxton site, what's left of it. And as I was, you know, trying to imagine this town that they were telling me about, I just was fascinated. I could not believe such a town existed in the middle of Iowa at that time in history. And so over the years, I would come and visit her, and I would go to the State Historical Society and do research, and I stumbled across the audio cassettes that the interviews that Dorothy Schweder had done as part of her research for her book, the grant she had gotten from the Department of Interior. And I was listening to these people talk about Buxton and what life was like there at that time, and I just became more and more fascinated. So I started, you know, listening to more, taking notes, starting to collect this file of information, never really knowing what I was ever going to do with it. And then when I moved to Iowa a couple of years ago, I said, you know, I think I want to turn that into a book. And so I did, pitched it to Arcadia, and they said yes, and that's how Lost Buxton was born.
Now, this is part of a series, is correct, The Images of America?
Well, yeah, Images of America is their historical series, you know, that has photographs and you know, combines historical quotes, and not really quotes, but information underneath each photo. What's interesting also is I wanted to do something a little bit different with this book in that their series traditionally have the photo and they have the, you know, the description of the photograph. Well, with so many of the photos with Buxton, some of them we would just have, there would just be a name of a person and not necessarily a lot of information known about that. And after listening to those audio cassettes, I really wanted this to be kind of the history of Buxton told in the voices or in the voices of the people. So I really coupled the photographs with quotes from residents and extracts from, you know, newspapers when I didn't have a quote from a person to really tell the story of Buxton as opposed to me putting something, you know, dry under there talking about the photos. So they let me do something a little bit different in the series, which I was really happy about.
What was so special about Buxton, Iowa?
Oh, goodness, where do you start, huh?
Where did it start?
Well, in addition to it being, well, let's say, first of all, it was very different from mining towns in general, not just taking into account the racial mix of the people, but also the town itself. It seemed to have been established with some level of permanence in mind, and that, you know, they had a really large company store. They had a really one of the largest industrial YMCAs, supposedly west in the Midwest and west of the Mississippi. One source said that. And then the town itself, people lived in houses. They weren't shacks. They were 1.5 stories, 5 to 6 room houses. And there were lots of things for people to do. There were lots of churches. There were over 40 independent businesses in town, which was very different from other mining towns. And so the town itself was very different for that time. And the people, that's pretty much what Buxton is probably known of most, is the most popular aspect of Buxton, was the fact that African Americans made up between 40% to 55% of the population for the first 14, 15 years of its existence. And not only was that the case, it was integrated. So you did not have African Americans living there in a segregated part of town. You had them integrated into the community, and they had a very thriving African American community there as well. So you had them doing well, and it was a very progressive town. So that was very different than other mining towns in Iowa and in the U.S.
When did Buxton come into existence? When did it go away?
It came into existence in 1900. It was established by the Consolidation Coal Company, who had pretty much was dominating the mining business at that time. And the last person in Buxton, or the last resident of Buxton, had pretty much left by 1914.
So we're talking about...
What amount of... Pardon me?
I'm sorry. We're talking about 14 years. Is that right? 1900 to 1914?
I'm sorry, 1914 is when they first started having the layoffs. I apologize. The last person in Buxton was around 1922, and then they moved the operations from there to Consol and Haydock as well. And then by that time, the residents there used to call that New Buxton. They would call, you know, the initial Buxton, Old Buxton, and then when the operations were moved to Haydock and Consol, they called that New Buxton. Well, that was pretty much done by 1927. So Buxton itself was through by 1922, and, you know, the two new mines or new communities were done by 1927.
So Buxton lasted, let's say, roughly a generation.
Yeah.
But there were people born in that environment. There are people, folks born there who were born and raised in Buxton. One generation,
yeah.
But still a generation.
Exactly. Which was really, in listening to them talk about their lives in Buxton, you know, when they talked about, especially the ones that were born there, and that was really pretty much all they knew at that time period, when they left Buxton, it was an adjustment for them because it really did feel like they were going back in time. In fact, one of the women who was a teacher there in Buxton had stated that it was very hard for her to get a job at teaching, and she had ended up doing some domestic and janitorial work because she couldn't get a job in teaching.
We're here in
South. Adjustment for them.
I can only imagine. We're here in Southeast Iowa, in Fairfield, Iowa. Can you give some of our listeners an idea where Buxton was? From Fairfield, Iowa, Southeast Iowa.
Buxton is about 8 to 12 miles north of Albia. So it was between Albia and Oskaloosa.
So we're probably talking about from Fairfield, Iowa, in our environs, somewhere a little bit more than an hour and a half from here. Driving by today's highways, today's roads.
Yeah.
Wow.
Sounds about right.
Not far. We were just, as part of the Keeping History Alive Foundation, we visited Salem, Iowa just 2 weeks ago, which was one of the stops. One of the stops for the Underground Railroad. And, you know, just that's 40 minutes away or half an hour away, and that's 20 minutes or 25 miles north of the Missouri border. And our tour guides told us back in that time and even now, it's like from Missouri to Iowa, it's two different worlds.
Yeah.
And imagine living in Buxton, just stepping outside that city, that town, and moving around about the state in that time in the 1900s, it was, again, like two different worlds.
It really was. And that's what was fascinating, too, to hear some of the residents talk about that, like even when they left, you know, just the surrounding farm communities, in fact. Like one of the gentlemen had talked about the fact that a lot of the farmers in that area were part of the Ku Klux Klan, and he had mentioned, his name was Clifford Lewis, he was born in about 1908, and he had mentioned that his father and his grandfather, uncle, was in the Klan. He wasn't, but they did. And this was in, a farming community that was, like I said, just on the outskirts of Buxton. So not only, did you have these people coming from the south to work in Buxton in the mines, and so, obviously the segregation and the violence and Klan activity and all, and Jim Crow, all that they were dealing with, you also had the people that were right, here in Iowa that had just, moved to Buxton. And so they were experiencing this, discrimination and racism just in areas surrounding Buxton. So it was really fascinating to hear that. It just made it seem like it was this surreal town in the middle of what was going on historically.
Images of America lost Buxton. How is it that Buxton came about? Why you mentioned that at one point, apparently from what you're saying, for most of its existence, just 22 years, but for most of its existence, the majority of its residents were African American, the miners.
Mm-hmm.
Where did they come from?
Up until about 1914.
Okay,
is when they were made up about 40% of the population.
Okay, 40%.
For the first 10 years, they were about 55% of the population.
Okay, okay. Where did they come from? How did they get there? These African Americans.
There was the Consolidation Coal Company was owned by the Chicago Northwestern Railroad. And they had first, Chicago Northwestern Railroid Consolidation had a camp in Muchikinock before Buxton. And so that was kind of the predecessor of Buxton.
How'd you say that again? Just Muchikinock? Is that what you said?
Mm-hmm.
Muchikinock,
yep.
Okay.
Muchie. The residents referred to it as just Muchie.
Muchie.
And so there, when the Consolidation, or when Chicago Northwestern Railroad had purchased Consolidation, they had changed the way the miners were being paid. And so the miners had gone on strike. And at that time, Consolidation had recruiters that then went to the South to get African Americans to come and work, to break the strike. And it's unclear whether they were told or whether or not, that's what they were coming there for.
That they were strike breakers.
But regardless, they did come. And Consolidation continued that process. When the mines played out in Muchie and they established Buxton in 1900, they continued that process of recruiting African Americans. And mainly it was from Virginia. But there were some, some folks that had said they had also, recruited people from a little bit from Missouri, not so much, a little bit from Kentucky, but it was mainly Virginia. And of course, the people there, it seemed like a lucrative opportunity because Consolidation was also not only relocating them, they would give them $20 a week as they learned the trade. I'm not sure for how long they were paid, but for a period of time, they were given housing and money to learn. So of course, then they would tell their friends, And you know, people would come. They would go visit or write letters and say, it's great, you know, times are good, you know, we're getting equal pay, you know, you should come to Buxton.
Hold on a second. Let's hear that again. They were getting equal pay. They were being paid the same as the other people being recruited to that city, that town. Is that
exactly.
Right?
They were being paid equal. And what was also interesting about that is when they continued recruiting African-Americans from the South, when Buxton was established in 1900, it was unionized. So they were, and consolidation encouraged the union, which was kind of surprising.
That is
surprising. Was not always the case. And so African Americans were getting equal pay at that time as well. But yet and still, the consolidation for the initial years continued to recruit African Americans from the South. And when there was really no financial incentive for them to do that because they were making the same amount of money. So that was an interesting fact I found kind of fascinating.
To recruit them for that many years, it suggests that they were Consolidated Coal was pleased with the work. They were good workers. They were producing.
Yep. And as I said, they didn't continue much once Buxton was established. I don't think they continued that process of actively going to the South to recruit for, you know, probably just the first two or three years. They didn't continue that for the life of Buxton.
The historical part that interests me is that sort of suggests there was then and for some time after some tension between unions and African Americans. African Americans were sometimes used as strike breakers. And this is an example of that. Although this seems like a very benevolent company, Consolidated Coal. You mentioned in your book, you talked about how they treated their workers. You mentioned something about there was a philosophy in place at that time, or popular among businesses, called corporate welfare or corporate socialism or something like that. I'm not sure what the word you used was. Do you remember that?
It was welfare capitalism.
Welfare capitalism, yeah.
Because there was a lot of speculation. You know, people have wondered, you know, why did Ben Buxton, who was a superintendent of Buxton at that time, why did they do this? Not only as it related to, you know, recruiting African-Americans, but why set up this town like this and, you know, give people this elaborate YMCA, let them have the freedom to, you know, live wherever they wanted, to give them real houses as opposed to shacks. Why in this fantastic company store, why do this when really you could have gotten away with doing nothing or very little, you know, just covering the basics? And so one of the things or the reasons that's been speculated is this concept of welfare capitalism, which was going on at that time around 1880. I think George Pullman, it started in the railroad industry, where George Pullman had set up this model community for the employees that were working on his streetcars, or his railroad cars, I should say. And so he set up this community that had, you know, nice housing, it had manicured lawns, it had a man-made lake, and it was this wonderful community. And the thinking there was that, well, if we provide a little bit more beyond, you know, the basic needs of our employees, if we give them a little bit more, then they will be productive workers. You know, they won't strike. They will, you know, they will produce. You're almost saying, you know, we'll have happy workers and they'll, you know, they'll be loyal to us almost. Those are my words, not necessarily Pullman's words. But so that was the thinking, that since Buxton was established around this time where this welfare capitalism was starting, that maybe that was why they had set up Buxton the way they did. There's no proof that that's the case, but that is one thing that's been, you know, given as a reason for why. Now, in terms of why the African Americans were treated, you know, equal, given equal pay, why it was integrated, have no idea why that's the case.
Interesting.
Well, it doesn't seem like the welfare capitalism philosophy lasted very long or won out in the business world.
No.
But by all accounts, or by any accounts, was Buxton a successful business venture?
Oh, it was.
They made money.
It was for them.
Yeah.
Pardon me?
The mining company made money.
Yeah. Which was another, you know, example of how well they were doing was the fact that a lot of the other mining companies, by restricting the miners or controlling their lives, like the entrepreneurial spirit or the businesses in town, or housing, like, for example, other mining companies, the miners had to live in company housing. And so that was revenue for them. They also had to shop at the company store. There was only one store. They did not really encourage free enterprise or encourage the people to start their own businesses. It wasn't allowed. So that was another source of income. Then here you have Buxton again, which has about 40, there were over 40 independent businesses in Buxton. And so the company let people start businesses as they could. They also, there were stories of where some of the miners would get injured from the mines. The company would either, they could loan, you know, take out a loan at the bank and start their own business because they couldn't work in the mines anymore. Or in one instance, the company had sold the soda factory to a miner who had lost fingers and couldn't mine. So the point is, that, again, to me, seems to be proof that the company was doing well if they're willing to lose revenue from, you know, housing and from, you know, other businesses that are competing with the company's store. So other examples of how well they were doing.
For sure. I'm a lawyer, and what one of the other many things that interest me about your book, about the wonderful photographs and quotes that you provide in your book, is that there were two attorneys, George Woodson and Dr. E. A. Carter. And as I read your book, George Woodson became a well-known attorney in Iowa, established, and I believe he got his start in Buxton, and he was one of the founders of the national. He first founded the Iowa Negro Bar Association, and then later he, with three other attorneys, African-American attorneys in Des Moines, founded the National Bar Association.
Yep. And he was also a co-founder of the Niagara Movement as well, which became the NAACP.
And this is a man who had strong roots with Buxton, Iowa.
Yep. And what's interesting, there's not as much information. And Dr. E.A. Carter was a medical doctor. But S. Joe Brown also, who was a prominent lawyer, very well known as well in Iowa, they had co-founded a law practice in Buxton. Now, I didn't read as much about S. Joe Brown and his sister in terms of, you know, their activities in Buxton. But it's interesting that they were both prominent attorneys and they both were very active in Buxton. Woodson was also very... very well known for his ability to, he was great at speaking, both in terms of winning cases, you know, persuading, you know, juries and winning cases, but also as a motivational speaker who spoke in Buxton and around Iowa, empowering African Americans to be, you know, financially secure, the importance of education, and he was known to be a very good and very persuasive speaker as well.
I believe Dr. E.A. Carter was, according to your book, he was the first African-American to obtain a medical degree from the State University of Iowa, what we call the University of Iowa today.
He was. And what's interesting about him and Woodson, they both were the sons of ex-slaves as well. And they both, you know, went on to become very, very successful men.
That I was going to save that question for the end, but you bring it up, and I wanted to bring it up anyway, sooner rather than later. Yeah, you had these men, very prominent, very accomplished, who were the sons of ex-slaves. So they're one generation removed. Their parents were in slavery. And maybe, I think you allude to this in your book, why, when you look back, when you spoke with people or you listened to recordings, that the African Americans who lived in Buxton looked at it differently, saw it differently than the Caucasians who lived in Buxton. A little bit more, or much more, I guess, nostalgic about it and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Because for the African American, and again, reading your book, it was compared to the world at large, or compared to just outside the borders of the town, it was truly a utopia. For Caucasians who lived there, well, you know, it was. It sounded like it was a nice company town, but you know what? They were going to be treated kind of like that pretty much wherever they went.
Right. And I think you hit upon, for me, that's why I was just so fascinated and why I couldn't really stop thinking about, you know, about the town, like when I would come back to Iowa and I would research more, was just because I just could not believe that, you know, where you have Buxton a mere, you know, 35 years after the 13th Amendment is passed and slavery is abolished, that you have this town that is there. And listening to the stories that some of the people told, they did talk about their grandparents had been slaves. And so one of the women, I think it was Hazel Stapleton, had said family dinner time was a time where the grandparents would tell stories of what it was like, you know, in slavery days. And so it was just very fascinating to hear that, as well as, like I said, thinking about, you know, Jim Crow as well at that time being very much not only the laws themselves, but, you know, the social customs of it that were guiding and restricting every aspect of life for African Americans. And, you know, just the smallest infraction or being accused of doing the smallest thing, you know, could result in, you know, death
mm-hmm.
or violence mm-hmm. or at the bare minimum, jail. And so it was those things, and then also mentioning the Ku Klux Klan being active throughout that, you know, that time period, depending on what resource you read. You know, Klan membership was, up until the mid-1920s, was between 2 and 4 million members nationwide. And so, once again, you have all of this severe oppression going on, but yet and still you have people in Buxton that have this freedom. And I wanted to just, if I could, just read one little thing, since we're on that topic, about why this was so important and summarizing that all together.
Please do.
If you don't mind.
Please do.
Okay. And just talking about why the differences, you know, people looked at it the same or looked at it differently.
Maybe tell us
to understand
from what section. Maybe you might want to tell us from what section you might be reading in your book, or what page.
Oh, this is just the chapter 8, where it talks about utopia, whether or not Buxton was a utopia, and the difference between the expression or the feeling that people had, the whites and blacks, and living in Buxton. So, the Buxton experience seemed to be different for Caucasian and African American residents. While most Caucasian residents interviewed viewed Buxton as a good place to live and felt they were treated fairly, its demise was not viewed with the same level of emotion experienced by the African American residents. Nearly all African American residents who were interviewed spoke positively and nostalgically about Buxton, ranking it as one of the best, if not the best, places they had ever lived. From the tone of their voices, from the words they used, it sounded like it could have been utopia. Some people seemed confused or perhaps annoyed by this viewpoint. Doris O'Brien of the Monroe County Historical Society and Museum stated, "In actuality, Buxton was ahead of its time. It's a shame it's gone. It should have been one of the best. It should be one of the best-known coal mining towns in the state. It didn't last long. It's gone but not forgotten." And then added, "The thing is, everybody has heard about how wonderful Buxton is. They've turned it into a myth. Well, we're dealing with reality. The reality being the gambling and murders reported in the papers. As previously stated, Buxton was not perfect. Nearly all residents interviewed agreed that there was gambling and drinking and some murders. But to understand this label of utopia is to view it in the context of the African American residents' experience. As I said just a moment ago, Buxton was started a mere 35 years after the end of slavery. Numerous African Americans interviewed stated that their parents and grandparents had been slaves, repeatedly sharing stories of their life of slavery. And those who had not been slaves still experienced extreme racism. They came from that to Buxton, a place where they could go anywhere they wanted, live any way they wanted, eat or shop where they wanted, and have the freedom they wanted. The freedom to live, the freedom to be, the freedom to choose. That must have felt like utopia."
Indeed it must.
Yeah.
You had mentioned, and earlier in your book, And this goes back to a point made by the person you're interviewing or quoted in this last passage you read, which thank you, by the way. There are different newspapers that wrote about Buxton. The different papers, depending on their audience or depending on what their point of view were, focused on different things about Buxton. There was a newspaper called the Iowa Bystander. Is that the name? Do I have it correct?
Yep, the Iowa State Bystander.
Tell us about the Iowa Bystander and what it would talk about or what it would write about when it would write about Buxton.
Well, the Iowa State Bystander is, if you go to, I think it's chroniclingamerica.gov, where they've, you know, made an effort to, you know, archive all these newspapers.
Could you say
they
that
have
again?
The Iowa State Bystander there from, I think, about maybe right before 1900 to about 1920. The Iowa State Bystander was the largest African-American newspaper in Iowa, and they covered Buxton pretty extensively. They had a dedicated reporter that would cover Buxton. And they also had a dedicated reporter for Ottumwa and Keokuk. Did I say that correctly? Keokuk?
Yes, Keokuk.
Okay. Other places as well. But what was interesting about the coverage of the places, Ottumwa, Keokuk, other places they covered, and especially Buxton, was they covered what life was like. They covered the notable people in Buxton. They covered what was happening, you know, in the various lodge functions, and Mrs. So-and-so is having a dinner, a ladies' dinner with, you know, such-and-such. And they covered a lot of, you know, the businesses that were opening in Buxton, the company store, the YMCA. And it really gives a really good glimpse into what was really happening, you know, day-to-day with the people, and really the successes of the town, the people that were doing well in Buxton, what, you know, mining was like in Buxton, what life was like in Buxton. So it is a great resource for really getting an idea of that side of Buxton. The other newspapers, and, you know, this is not to say all the stories were sensationalized, but there were a lot of sensationalized headlines, like the Oskaloosa Herald or the Eddyville Tribune, the Albion Republican, that were, you know, murder in Buxton. A lot of those types of headings, and they did cover other things, but they also had a lot of those headings. Whereas the Bystander didn't have much of that. They would maybe mention that somebody died or there was a problem, but that wasn't the bulk of their newspaper. So that contrast is very interesting in that I found the Bystander was really fascinating to giving that kind of insider glimpse of what life was like living in Buxton as a resident.
The Bystander, the way you describe it, and I did some research when I was in college reading African-American newspapers, the Bystander showed the life of the African-American in those towns as full. They had social life. They had schools. They had churches. They had things that other people had, and they did things that other people did. They were normal. But you understanding the environment that you're in, where just outside of Buxton, there were terrorist groups like the Ku Klux Klan and so forth. Those were papers written for people who wanted to see that environment of predominantly, or at least to a large extent, African-American, as the stereotype was in that era, and is still used, I think, in large part today, as less than fully human, less than having full lives. And so they'll focus on the things which feed maybe, unfortunately, a stereotype of being hyperviolent or
aberrant in some way
to gambling and so forth, these sort of things. Yeah. So you focus on that, and you make, that's what you write your articles about, and the other things are not so important because they're not going to sell newspapers, and they're not what your reader expects.
Exactly.
But the Bystander, differently, and I think we're so great we have available to look at that on online now. I think the website is, what was it?
chroniclingamerica.loc.gov. It's a Library of Congress website.
Can give somebody who's interested in this area a fuller, richer picture.
Exactly.
And you're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. Our guest host today is Paul Gandy, and our author guest is Rochelle Chase, author of Lost Buxton. And this is the first nonfiction book that you've written. Is that correct, Rochelle?
It is. Yep.
Do you think you'll do more?
Yeah, I do. It's challenging. I mean, well, writing in general is challenging for me. Who is it that said? I think it was Dorothy Parker that said, "I hate writing. I love having written." That describes me, because at the end of the day, when I've written something that I think that I'm proud of, then it's like, wow, that feels great, but the process isn't so great. But so nonfiction had, in this book, had its own set of challenges in that, first of all, I had to have photos, and for a while there I wasn't sure this was going to happen because, you know, finding photos was difficult. And, you know, the African American Museum also in Cedar Rapids came to the rescue with photos, in addition to, you know, the State Historical Society, as Paul had mentioned, some of the other sources, the local sources, John Jacobs, Michael Limburger. And so finding images was a challenge, for one thing. Then finding historical, you know, the information to what you know, the history of Buxton was a challenge, because also, there's so much conflicting information out there, and even conflicting information about who's in photos, and so weeding through that and trying to find out, okay, well, what's the correct information is a challenge. So all of those things were challenging, but at the end of the day, I just loved the digging into history and really learning. And now what I'm trying to do as well, since I'm not a historian, is, you know, as I go out and as I speak about Buxton, that as people, you know, ask me questions of things that I don't know the answer to, that I want to start, you know, doing articles and posting that online, you know, so I can build my knowledge more and also dig deeper. And so to answer your question, I would like to do something else historical. I'm not really sure what that's going to look like yet, but I do know that I also want to do a historical fiction book set in Buxton. I really want to explore some of the things that I couldn't explore, you know, being confined to nonfiction and having to stick to the facts, but really explore some of those other topics that I just find intriguing. So I think that will be my next project, new historical.
I don't know if you'll take this as an idea, but I was looking on page 49 of your book, and there's a picture of a lady by the name of Lottie Armstrong Baxter. The picture is taken around 1910. And I believe Lottie was a manager of a bank.
Right.
This is a quote from Charles Linger, who was a Caucasian resident. Lottie was African American. But I remember she looks like she's a pretty astute businesswoman. But what I also notice is the incredibly small waist that women apparently had to appear to have. I don't know how she was breathing.
Oh, I know.
I don't know how she'd be. Her waist looked like you could put your hand around it.
I know.
So
one hand.
Buxton was a town that, like other, they were not immune to the fashions of the day, apparently.
That's for sure.
That's what I found. Well, I find so much fascinating. I keep saying that. That's what I found. In a second. Here's another thing. Is the fact that there were various classes in Buxton. You know, you had the working class, which were the miners and or the women that, you know, all they had, you know, time to do was take care of their families. And then you had the women that, you know, were a little bit more well off, and, you know, they belonged to the various, you know, lodges or the women's organizations, things like that, and they dressed very elegantly, I'm sorry. And so you had that side too, and so that is very fascinating as well. And so I think you're right, Paul, that would make a great character.
Right, and we see how the miners got here, that the coal company went in and recruited them. But the doctors, the attorneys, the tradespeople that came to Buxton, I'm sure they didn't all come there as miners and then suddenly become attorneys, etc. How did they come to Buxton? What is their connection with Iowa? Do you know? Were you able to find out anything about that?
Not really. And to be honest, I didn't really find out about that. What I did find out about or find information on is there were actually a lot of the men who did come there as miners, and they would start the businesses on the side. You know, so they would mine during the day. They might run the business on the weekend, or their family members, you know, might, the kids might help with the business. For example, Reesby was an example of one where he was a miner and had worked in the mines, and then he used to go around and sell to the men that were gambling. He had a little basket he would carry around, and he would sell food that his wife had cooked, and he'd make money that way. And over time, he made so much money that he could then open up a lunch cart in front of the YMCA. And so then he would, when he was working in the mines before it was, you know, generating enough money, he would then, you know, his wife, he would run it on the weekends, and his wife and daughters would do the cooking. And it's estimated, according to his son, that they went through like 200 to 250 chickens, you know, in a weekend. So he was just one example. And then he also was able to then take that money when he was one of the ones that moved to Haydock, and then was able to, like, open restaurants, buy property. So he did very well, and that was something that he started as a miner there. So there are stories that I have read about miners starting businesses, but I haven't really come across stories, you know, about men that came and brought their businesses there. So I don't have any information to share about that.
Lest the listener think otherwise, this is a significant and sizable town. On the same page, we have a picture of Lottie Armstrong Baxter. Beneath it, there's a picture of the male employees at the company's store. And if I can quote from this or read from this for just a moment, Rochelle, it said, "There are 50 men and about 35 ladies employed at this great building, of whom 18 are colored. A colored gentleman is the oldest man in the company employ, from the point of service, having been there for about 21 years. And when you look in this photograph, or you look at it, and it kind of looks like a college glee club photograph.
Yeah.
You see a fully integrated
in the company store.
There's a fully integrated company, fully integrated picture.
Wow.
Yeah. For that many people to work in the store means this is a sizable town. About how big did it get?
Well, that population has been all over the map, too, you know, with even some of the residents saying, oh, there's about 14,000 people in Buxton. But it seems like there are about 5,000, around 5,000 people in Buxton. And those numbers were based on, you know, some research, not that I did, but from Dorothy Schweder's research, where she had looked at census records. Also looked at the plat map, and judging by the number of houses that they think were built in Buxton, and, you know, the number of miners that worked in the mines, it seemed like 5,000 was about, you know, the population there in Buxton. I did want to say one other thing when you pointed out this photo. There was another photo that I couldn't find who was the owner of, so I didn't include it in here to get the rights to use it. But there was a photo of the women that worked in the company store as well. And same thing. They all had, you know, their white shirts, you know, button-up, you know, blouses on, and their long, you know, skirts. And it's the same kind of thing. It looks like the same kind of, you know, formal photo that was taken, which was quite impressive as well, because you also had the African-American and the Caucasian, you know, women clerks working in the store as well. So I just wanted to point that out when you pointed that picture. I wanted to make a note of that there's a similar photo of the women as well.
You know, I'm looking at this picture of Lottie Armstrong Baxter, and Paul had pointed out how narrow her waist is. It makes me wonder if they had Photoshop back then. Pretty sure they didn't.
Yes. I think they had something worse, right? I don't know what the time of corsets and such, you know, where you were using all those things that bound you in. So I'm thinking, I'm guessing she had to have something.
Yeah. Two questions come to mind. The women in that photo, the women in the photograph that you didn't get rights to, and generally speaking, this company town, were they paid equally with the men? Or is that a question you don't know the answer to?
No, that one I don't know the answer to. In fact, I don't know what even the men made in the company store. I don't know.
Now, Rochelle, I'm curious too how you came to Iowa. Do you have family history in Iowa?
I don't. To the short answer of that is really cost of living. I was living in San Francisco for a long period of time, and
expensive.
I had started traveling around, just kind of figuring out where I wanted to live. And because I do independent consulting as a business analyst, and so when in between my contracts, I take time off. So I was really trying to and focus on writing and other business efforts. And so I really was looking for lowering my cost of living so that I could take more time off in between contracts. And the writing instructor that I mentioned at the beginning of the interview, Lee Michaels, since I used to come visit her over time, I just said, you know what? I'm tired of looking. I'm tired of hopping around from state to state. I'm just going to pick a place. I'm just going to buy a house. I'm going to settle there. So that's how Iowa ended up being in the picture.
Ottumwa, and you know, it's probably not the most. Iowa may not be a state that comes to the top of minds for African Americans looking to relocate.
Mm-hmm.
So,
true. Nope, it's not.
But Lee has been a guest on Writer's Voices in the past, and I also took a writing course from her probably 25 years ago.
Top of mind comes to mind. Yeah. Top of mind. We're in the mind.
Awesome.
It's
fantastic.
Out of the mind.
It's out of mind, yeah.
The folks in Buxton had fun, right? They're a town, and they're folks. These are hardworking miners, young families. They also had success outside the town. Can you talk to us about their baseball team?
Oh, yeah. The Buxton Wonders it's interesting. They were very well known throughout, not just in Buxton, but throughout Iowa. They were originally started, B.F. Cooper, who was the pharmacist there in town, had started.
Rochelle, can I interrupt just one second? Rochelle, I want to interrupt just one second. This is a time when baseball was the number one, well, no question, baseball was the most popular sport in this country. Football was nowhere close at this point.
Right.
Okay.
And they were very well known. In fact, they started off as an 100% African American team. And it was said that they were good enough to have been, you know, professional players had it been a different time and they had been allowed to play. But they weren't. And what's interesting is listening to some of the stories that the residents said. They seemed like they were quite the showmen in terms of. Do you remember the Harlem Globetrotters?
Yes.
Yeah, it seemed like they were like that. In that, like one of the, I think it was the pitcher Zeebo. I think his nickname was. And they used to make comments about how he would do flips, you know, while waiting for the ball to be passed to him and still manage to strike, you know, a player out. So they were always doing things like that on the field to entertain the people as well as, you know, playing, being really good players. And I think one of the white residents had said, yeah, they got away with that because they were that good, you know, mm-hmm. that they were excellent. And so they were very well known, like I said, throughout Iowa, not just in Buxton. And these guys were minors during the day. So they did this in their spare time, and they did not get paid for it, but they did it because, as Herman Brooks, who was one of the players as well, said, it was for the love of the game. They loved baseball.
Now, before we run out of time, because we only have about 10 minutes left, Buxton disappeared from the map, but it didn't disappear from the hearts and minds of its residents for quite a while. I have a very close friend whose family was is African American and came to Jefferson County, was the first African American to own farmland in this part of the state. And when I asked his father, who's 80, I believe, if he remembered, had ever heard of Buxton, he goes, oh, yeah, we used to go to the Buxton reunion picnics.
Right.
So tell us a little bit about the Buxton reunions.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's been hard to find people, you know, it fizzled out. They used to have reunions every so often where residents would get together and they would pretty much, you know, hang out and you know, remember times in Buxton. It was this major event, usually covered in the paper, you know, with the media there as well. And it just kind of fizzled over time, you know, as the residents were getting older and, you know, and dying off, and then the younger people weren't as interested in it. And it fizzled. What I find interesting, though, is there is a picture towards the end of the book which had It was like 4,000. It was one of the Buxton reunions, and it had about 4,000 people in it. What I found really interesting about that photo was that, you know, you're talking about Buxton being a diverse town and being integrated and people living, you know, side by side, but yet and still you have this reunion picture that was taken in 1938 where you don't really have that diversity that, that we're talking about there. So I found that interesting that, you know, is it because it wasn't really, I don't know. I don't know why that's the case, but it's an interesting thought that maybe that's kind of that, that testimony to people getting, being segregated. You know, once you left Buxton, then there wasn't that sense of inclusion anymore. That's I don't know if that's the case, but I found that interesting.
That is a great photograph, by the way. It's a wonderful photograph. It looks like it could be a painting, you know.
It looks like it's what?
It looks like it could be a painting. It looks like it could be some sort of impressionistic painting the way it looks in your book. But I don't know why either, obviously, but there's a quote you, there's someone you quote in your book that may give us a clue as to why in 1938 that reunion picture looks different than the way things may have been if they had taken that picture, let's say, in 1920 or 1923, right after the town disappeared. This is a, if I'm going to read this quote. You wrote, you put it in your book, but a guy said it. Or actually, I'm going to ask you, if you don't mind, if you could read the quote on page 104. And maybe you could give us a setup for that quote before you say it. Because I think for our listeners, that might give them a clue as to what may have changed or what happened after this town went away.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're talking about the quote from Charles Taylor.
Yes.
In Des Moines.
Yes.
Okay. This is from Charles Taylor, was an African-American there, and he said, "We had everything we wanted, everything we would need in Buxton. I didn't know anything about segregation until I got here," meaning Des Moines. "I didn't know what they were talking about. The only jobs they had in Des Moines was shining shoes and that kind of junk, and I didn't feel like doing none of that. So I went to school. I didn't want no part of none of that junk." And that was by Charles Taylor.
Any idea what Charles Taylor was able to do as a career?
I believe he was the one, he went to school and learned auto repair and did something in auto repair.
Now, let me just say, there's nothing wrong with doing that sort of thing regarding the shoes. I go to Des Moines from time to time, and there's a older African-American man, must be 80 plus. He looks like he was there before the building was built and will be there after. And he's one of those guys, he says, "How you doing, Gandy? How you doing? You doing all right? You doing all right?" He's always asking me if I'm doing all right. And I know he probably has six figures in CDs in a bank somewhere because he's always asking me that. You know, that kind of guy. That kind of guy. So I think he's doing all right, obviously. But I think part of what happened, I don't know, Rochelle, I'm just asking, people went different, there are different ways from 1922 to, for example, this photograph in 1938, and they experienced the world differently than they did in Buxton. So even though there was a call for a reunion, the feeling was sort of muted because of all the 17 years, that the generation, or almost a generation, that had passed from the time of the town disappearing. Families, people had grown older, had families and so forth, so there wasn't the same pull for the African Americans, at least, to come back to this reunion because they knew coming back it would not be a utopia.
You know, that could have been the case too, and I thought about that, you know, but then when I looked at some of the ones like from the later ones, like the 60s, because they continue that beyond, and there were some later ones, then I did see more of, you know, a mixed crowd. Now, the crowd wasn't as large as that. It wasn't, you know, 4,000 people like that one. But it was, it was more integrated. So that's what gave me pause. So, yeah,
When were those photographs taken in the 60s? When were those reunions? Were they after?
Sorry, what was that?
Those reunions that took place in the 60s, they were probably during, I'm just speculating. I'm guessing they were during the Civil Rights Movement.
Exactly.
So there were reunions later on during the 60s?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's probably what Leroy remembers going to.
And I'm guessing as African Americans were feeling empowered, they were feeling less afraid. And so, yeah, I want to go back and revisit this past because you know what? There's something about that past that we're able to create again, and this time a little bit more permanently.
Now, Rochelle, you mentioned that Lost Buxton is part of the Images of America series from Arcadia Publishing. How did you find your publisher?
Well, one way was, Lee's been a great resource. She had done the Temwa book and the history book with Arcadia, and I asked her opinion, you know, what did she think about them as a publisher? Did she think, you know, they were, you know, just kind of getting her opinion. And she said they were great, that she really liked working with them. And I thought, okay, let me give it a try. Because I was actually thinking of doing it myself also, because I really wanted it to be a picture book. I wanted it to have pictures and quotes, like I said. Mm-hmm. So then when she mentioned them, I thought, well, if they're willing to go along with the vision that I have for this book, let me see. And so then I pitched to them, and they liked the idea, and they said, sure, let's do it.
Do you have any idea how many books are in this series, The Images of America?
Oh, gosh, no. It's actually a line. You know, it's called the Image of America series, but it's like a line that they have, and I have no idea how many they have.
I know there's one on Mount Pleasant, because we were sent that one as well. It was recently published also.
Yeah. Oh, no, that's all over the U.S. This is their area. They specialize in regional history, and mm-hmm. so that's their line of regional history, you know, for photo books all over the U.S.
Oh, cool.
I wonder if there's one about Swedesburg. I'm curious about that.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Well, if you have an idea, then pitch to them. They're great to work with.
So are you? Have you published your romance books as well?
I got the rights back. I was writing romance for Kensington Publishing, and I got the rights back to those, 2015. And so I reissued those, and then I wrote a new one that I had issued as well. But yeah, so they have about nine, if you count the small ones, published works out right now in romance.
So when you talk about writing a historical novel about Buxton, will it be a romance?
No, I don't think I want it to be. There might be a romantic element or component of it, but it won't be a romance.
All right. Well,
because I think I really want to deal with like more gritty things. I want to deal with, I don't want to be confined to a happy story. Not that it'll be unhappy, but I just mean I want to deal with real life problems.
Really a fine book. The photographs are something that, you know, we're all so busy these days. Who has time to read? But take the time to read this book. At least take the book. It's inexpensive, and go through and look at the photographs, really some fine photographs that tell a very, very interesting story.
And Rochelle, we're almost out of time, but we forgot to mention you'll be doing a book reading in Fairfield. Can you give us the details?
Yes, I will be at Revelations in Fairfield on March 11th at 1:30.
All right, that is Saturday, March 11th. Is that,
yep,
no.
Saturday, March 11th.
No, that's... Yeah, Saturday, March 11th. Okay, 1:30, Revelations in Fairfield. And the rebroadcast of the show is Monday morning at 8 a.m., so if you missed part of it or you want to tell your friends, you can pick it up there. Stay tuned now for Planet Erstwhile with James Moore. And thank you for being with us, Paul.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thank you, Rochelle.
Thank you for having me, too.
All right. Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUU-LP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com.